Casting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia, this is CJSF 90.1 FM.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we examine the spinelessness of Canadian news media on the North State, break down how government inaction's endangering more than 1,000 grad students from Gaza who've been accepted into Canadian universities on Press Progress sources, and explain why billionaire wealth flight is an empty threat on the Broadbent Institute's perspectives. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at Unrigged.ca. This episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by The Alberta Advantage. Based in Calgary, this collective of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from an April 2017 episode, the team take a deep dive into the NDP's past in a conversation exploring the 1969 Waffle Manifesto. Now, here's the show.
There are two strategic areas where if you don't talk about nationalization, this document becomes a waffle document.
This is still waffling because all you're saying is key industries. You know, I don't think it's any less of a waffle, if you want to put it that way, than what is here already.
Makes no difference where I go. You're the best hometown I know. Hello, Calgary, you know we love you. Makes no difference.
The Alberta Advantage is a bi-monthly political commentary podcast that offers analysis on Calgarian and Albertan politics from a left-wing perspective.
You know we love you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Alberta Advantage. Get out your maple syrup, because we're here to talk about the waffle. Joining Team Advantage today are special guests Roberta Lexier, Associate Professor at Mount Royal University.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here, as well as our Edmonton correspondent, Trevor.
Hello.
Around the table, we also have...
Bodie.
Karen.
Patrick.
Amir.
And myself, your host, Kate Jacobson. So let's start with the basics, with the waffle. What was the waffle? When was it active? Who was involved?
So the Waffle was founded in 1969, and really it came out of a manifesto that was drafted called For an Independent Socialist Canada. And the point of the manifesto was to try and raise some important issues within the NDP, specifically around Americanization of the Canadian economy was the key issue, but also issues around Quebec nationalism, and some other issues emerged later. In 1969, they were formed. They take the resolution or the manifesto to the federal convention that year in Winnipeg, I think the convention was, where it's responded to by the establishment of the NDP with what become referred to as the Marshmallow Resolution. It does accept some of the points of the Waffle Manifesto, but really leaves behind a lot of the more radical points of the manifesto. After the manifesto was rejected by the federal convention, the Waffle goes back and decides to start submitting resolutions to federal and provincial conventions of the NDP, trying to push the NDP in various directions, primarily to the left. And some of those were accepted. Most of those were rejected. In 1971, one of the leaders of the WAFL, James Laxer, who recently sadly passed away, ran for the federal leadership against David Lewis, almost won. It came down to a fourth ballot. It was pretty shocking. And after that, the NDP got very concerned about the WAFL and decided to basically boot them from the party. They continue to organize, some of them anyway, some stay within the NDP, into another organization called a Movement for an Independent Socialist Canada, and then basically disappear off the map by 1973, 1974, around there.
So yeah, pretty short-lived then.
Yes, about 5 years at the maximum point.
So the name The WAFL, I love it. I don't know how popular that opinion is around the table. Amir, I don't think you're a huge fan of the name The WAFL.
Oh, I'm actually a great fan. I was just disappointed it was not a reference to, like, a breakfast food, but more to something about, like, waffling in the left.
Yeah, so future NDP leader Ed Broadbent said if they had to choose between waffling to the left and waffling to the right, they waffle to the left. The WAFL was like an attempt to introduce these ideas of like the 1960s new left into the NDP and push the party to the left. And they were really big into this idea of like left economic nationalism.
I think one of the interesting things about that is that the WAFL leadership, at least Jim Laxer and some others, had been really involved in the Canadian student movement in the 1960s. And they raised a lot of concerns, Jim Laxer in particular, about the American dominance within the student movement, that all the issues they were raising were American, the war in Vietnam, civil rights, other sorts of issues, and that the tactics they were using were all taken from the United States. And so he was pushing much earlier than this for a nationalization of the student movement, saying, we're Canadian, we need to deal with Canadian issues, we need to deal with Quebec, we need to deal with First Nations, we need to deal with this federation that we have, and most importantly, we need to deal with the dominance of the American Empire in Canada itself. And so I think for me, when I look at the history of the WAFL, that interesting transition from that nationalization push in the student movement into the kind of looking for other opportunities for nationalization and seeing the NDP as a potential ally, I suppose, or a potential location for nationalization to happen. And then they really start to push on the economic side, which I think comes a lot from Mel Watkins, who was an economist.
One of the things that, well, that I found interesting was that, so in the New Left in the 60s, you had all these anti-colonial and anti-imperialist struggles, and a lot of it was based on the tension of, you know, like the colonies versus the empires. And it's almost like the WAFL, in order to be able to fit to that trendy discourse, they kind of created this whole concept of Canada being basically in the same side as Vietnam or something. I don't know, I find it a little ham-fisted, but this is my first impression.
No, I definitely think that's like a real concern with left economic nationalism, and particularly like left political economics as applied to Canada, is there is a tendency to see Canada as like a periphery state because, I don't know, we have like a lumber industry or like there's resource extraction here. But I definitely think there's like a lot of critiques of this. It's very important to see Canada like as a country in the global north, as a core economy, as like a capitalist state.
Canada is a colonizer and a northern country, a global power, but it's also a former colony and has always had that tension between being a colony and being a colonizer. And I think we're only now starting to talk about the colonizer part in terms of First Nations and mining interests in Central America, all those sorts of things. And I think at the time there really was this sense that Canada was acting as a colony, in particular to this really dominant empire to the south, which was the American Empire. And we have to remember this is the Cold War. So there's two empires. Mm-hmm. There's the American Empire and the Soviet Empire. And Canada was kind of a peripheral nation within that two-state system or two-empire system. And so there was that sense that it was a colony. But I think at the same time, what they were saying is that Canada has its own problems and we have to start looking at Canada's problems and solve Canada's problems and stop just adopting the U.S. models and the U.S. issues. That civil rights, there was an interesting article that came out early in the 60s about students demonstrating about civil rights. It was after the Selma March in Alabama. There was a big protest in Toronto at the U.S. Consulate. People saying, you know, civil rights, you know, the African-American struggle is super important. And this article came out in the Globe and Mail and said, yeah, okay, but we have our own civil rights issues in Canada that we're totally ignoring, that there's poverty on reserves and there's other sorts of issues. So I think they were trying to balance that conflict that Canada holds a really weird position, especially in the late 1960s. And I think we do have to acknowledge the importance of that American empire, that they really were dominant. One of the issues that comes up in the waffle is around the labor movement, for instance. This is one of the reasons that the NDP wanted to boot the waffle from the party, is that most of the trade unions at that time were international unions. Now, international workers' solidarity is a thing labor unions often talk about, but those unions were actually American unions. They were headquartered in the United States. And Canadian unions, or people fighting for independent Canadian unions, were saying they don't know our issues. They don't understand our economy. They don't understand our political system. We need independent Canadian unions.
The union issue is also a historic one. So especially in the prairies, that's how the one big union really managed to get inroads into the prairie provinces, is they appealed to Canadian workers' sense that their union dues were going to these conservative, ineffectual trade unions in the states. They would never approve strike funds, things like that. And that's how the one big union really got its start in Western Canada in particular. So there's definitely a big history in Canada of that.
There's a fun Alberta context to that. There was a video recorded to highlight the 50-year anniversary of the formation of the NDP in Alberta, and they were interviewing activists who were involved with the CCF at the time. And Alberta was a bit of a laggard in jumping on board with the new party. And one of the reasons one of the members voiced in that is they were worried about the right-wing influence of the labor movement on the party.
Yeah, I think it's important at this time too. Again, I'm a historian, so I have to put everything in historical context, that the NDP was only formed in 1961. So when the waffle came around, that's only 8 years after the formation of the new party. And the new party is formed as a way to bring the labor unions on side to the party. Before that, the CCF had been a federation of a large number of different groups, mostly farmers, co-ops, religious, social gospelers, other sorts of people with some union involvement. But there was an attempt to try and bring the unions in a much more official way and make the party a labor party along the lines of the British Labor Party and others. That was really the main influence. And so the unions have been brought on side as in 1961 as part of this movement, and were given a lot of power within the party. They get a certain number of seats on the federal council. They get a certain number of block votes. They get all sorts of sort of special considerations as being labor unions. And there was a thought at the time that unions were radical left organizations, that they were the workers who would overthrow capitalism and, you know, the proletariat would rise. As we know, labor unions really aren't that oftentimes. They tend to focus on collective bargaining and on getting the best deals for their workers. And that often isn't about changing governments. It's often not about radical solutions to economics.
We've sort of like covered labor unions quite well, I think. I would love to move on to the Waffle Manifesto itself. So who wrote it, what its components looked like, and how it really differed from existing NDP policy. So this manifesto was sort of the expression of the Waffle movement, and they believed that the NDP could function as the parliamentary wing of what they called a movement dedicated to fundamental social change.
Yeah, I mean, I think just we can start with the starting point. It's just like our aim as democratic socialists is to build an independent socialist Canada. Our aim as supporters of the new Democratic Party is to make it a truly socialist party. So those are pretty strong words that you don't hear that straightforward these days.
So I guess I'm not well acquainted with 60s political climate of the NDP. I'm wondering what part of this was actually controversial to the mainstream that they didn't like this, you know?
Well, the first word is socialist. I think the entire history of certainly the NDP, less so the CCF, but probably most of that history as well, is just that kind of having a problem saying the word socialist or going on to the doors of regular voters and Canadians saying, like, yes, we're socialists, because it's always social democrat, social democracy inspired by socialism, but it's not very straightforward most of the time. So
having the courage to at least recognize that American empire is the biggest obstacle to worldwide socialism. I mean, that's...
Yeah, and I do think some of my favorite analysis of this is this idea that Canadian governments have functioned in the interest of international capitalism, and particularly American capitalism. And I think that's quite insightful analysis of actually the role that, like, the Canadian government has played in international capitalism. We see, like, for the most part of Canadian history, we're pretty much like a willing kind of lackey to American empire.
That was the Alberta Advantage. Find out more at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Launching in October 2024, news criticism podcast The North State features journalist Scott Martin punching through the noise biweekly and tackling how news media frames issues, omits information, and pushes the status quo. Like on this recent episode where Scott talking about Prime Minister Carney's Davos speech and the spinelessness of Canadian news media in this full-length monologue. Now, here's the show.
The North State is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Hello, everybody, and welcome to 2026. In the last episode of 2025, I said that we would return mid-January. Well, let's just say a lingering cough from strep throat doesn't exactly make for great conditions to record a podcast. Anyway, I just spent about an hour and a half shoveling snow, and I figured when better to record the first episode of the year when I'm exhausted from that. There's a lot I've got planned for the catch in the North State in the next month or so, but to ease back into it, I thought I would just do a monologue about something I've noticed since the beginning of last year and what that means for Canada's politics and news ecosystem. First of all, I want to point to something I wrote about last week in the catch that has been impossible to ignore if you're Canadian. And that's the breathless and unlimited praise heaped on Prime Minister Mark Carney for his speech at the World Economic Forum. In Davos, Switzerland, Carney made a sales pitch to the wealthy elite of the world. Canada is stable and ready for your money. If that wasn't the takeaway you've seen from the coverage, it's because he bolstered this by admitting that the post-World War II order, based on international law, was a lie. American hegemony, which he admitted prospered Canada, has now become a liability. First, let's acknowledge these statements as true. The thing is, these true statements by Carney are used in service of further economic exploitation. Like I said, I wrote a piece on it in The Catch, which you can read in the show notes, but I want to add another voice into this critique. I can't believe it, but I'm going to quote a LinkedIn post from Vincent Wong, assistant professor at the University of Windsor Faculty of Law. He put this into extremely poignant words. It's a bit long, but I think it's worth reading, so here's a bit of it. Quote, "Third world scholars and officials have long argued that global markets and international law are constructed, enforced, and ignored in ways that continuously advantage states with power, especially in the global north, and that crises are routinely externalized onto the global self, whose formal sovereignty is undermined and erased whenever it conflicts with great power interests. When these claims are made by third world scholars, they are dismissed as ideological. When a G7 former central banker says them, they are suddenly treated as sober realism. The analysis has not changed. Only who is speaking." Unquote. So while what Carney is saying is by all accounts true, what's more important than what he's saying is the fact that he's saying it. And I don't mean, oh, Canada is leading the world and blah, 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 blah. I mean a global North power is deploying rhetoric to separate itself from the U.S. on the international stage. Now, Carney's not actually doing that. The bolstered military spending inevitably will benefit the U.S. The sales to ICE, the critical minerals mining, and the participation in NORAD and the Golden Dome, presumably, all point to that. But it is notable. Meanwhile, the wider Canadian response to this new approach to imperialistic and colonial ambitions from the U.S. is to pretend as though it's unprecedented in the world. In reality, it's merely what the underlying goals of U.S. foreign policy have been since the turn of the 20th century, supercharged by their superpower status at the end of World War II. Canada participated in the bloody colonial carnage of the Korean War. This country provided arms and supplies for the U.S. military effort in Vietnam. The U.S. military tested Agent Orange in New Brunswick before using it to murder and disfigure countless Vietnamese, Laotian, and Cambodian people. Canada has directly meddled in the affairs of Haiti since at least the beginning of this century. So where exactly is the coverage that analyzes this aspect? Now, don't get me wrong. Just because I'm frustrated with his speech doesn't mean I can't recognize its significance. A world leader took the stage and effectively said what we're all thinking. In history books, this will probably mark the beginning or ending of a period with a neat demarcation line. And yes, it was a good speech. But it was a speech at a conference that then hosted Jared Kushner's plan to build skyscrapers, resorts, an airport, and industrial parks on the mass grave of Palestinians murdered by Israel with U.S. funding. Where exactly was that going to come up in Carney's speech? It wasn't, because Canada has been a willing participant in the genocide. If you felt pride in the speech, this is not an admonishment. Canadians are so desperate for a win, they'll take an opportunistic banker making a sales pitch to the world's wealthiest as proof that we're the new leaders of the free world. But we can't allow ourselves to be conned by feel-good neoliberalism. This problem is a result of policies that have dominated the globe since the 80s, policies that Carney is pursuing. But if that was what all this episode was about, I would just read my article verbatim. I'm proud of it, so I'm not opposed to doing that, but I want to join this idea with one of the more consequential things from 2025. Did you notice that the critical component of the news ecosystem has been completely eviscerated? It's hard to believe, but all the problems of the past decades have come to roost squarely on the information systems that we use to perceive the world around us. Canadian weapons were found in the hands of the Rapid Support Forces, a paramilitary group that has been committing massacres in Sudan. Shortly afterwards, Carney signed a $70 billion deal with the United Arab Emirates, which have been credibly linked to supporting the RSF. Around the same time, CBC News reported that ICE ordered 20 armored vehicles from a firm based in Brampton. As far as we know, Canadian parts are still going to the Israeli military. Where has the outcry been about this? Where has the reporting on the outcry been on this? Now, there is an obvious contradiction in what I just said. Canadian news outlets reported on each of these developments. But in terms of challenging hegemony, that's nowhere to be found. Carney's speech, basically stolen from the discussion groups of the Non-Aligned Movement and Decolonial Scholars, papered over the lie of the international rules-based order to say that Canada and other middle powers could do it better. Clearly, Carney meant the usual players. Europe, the Anglosphere, South Korea, Japan. But when he says that it's important for these countries to mark their own path, why are these stories of tangible actions Canada has taken not brought up? Excuse me, but I thought the news was supposed to challenge power, not shine its shoes and ask for a gratuity of having the chance to do it again. Sorry, I usually try not to be flippant like that. I regularly maintain in my work that journalism typically supports the broader power structure. I mean, if you're a regular follower, you've probably heard me say the words like, news media hasn't failed because failing means they had a goal they haven't met. But there is something markedly different about news media now, and it's that it's desperate to cling to relevance. The collapse of news media to meaningfully challenge governments has been starkly apparent below the border. Barry Weiss's control of CBS News, aligning with the Trump administration, the mealy-mouthed garbage from the New York Times, the Washington Post explicitly abandoning its purported principle that democracy dies in darkness. That's not to mention the litter of right-wing gremlins flooding the White House press corps. But if I can twist a phrase for a moment, the greatest trick that Canada ever pulled was convincing us that, since our evil wasn't at the level of the United States, it didn't exist. The Conservative Party had denied entry to their 2023 Quebec City Convention to three independent journalists. Natasha Bolowski for the National Observer, Martin Lukash from The Breach, and Nora Loretto, who was reporting for The Maple. They didn't give a reason, but it was pretty evident why. Since then, Poilievre and his party barred journalists from riding on the campaign buses. Some of his staffers got physical with journalists. Post-debate scrums were dominated by rebel news who made a mockery of the whole situation. Now, as the National Observer reports, the Conservative Party has created a new category of media accreditation for content creator. In an analysis piece, Arno Kopecky reports that he has not been approved for accreditation despite having applied over 20 days before the writing of this piece, while the Pleb Reporter, an open Polyev supporter, has been. I recommend you read the piece. I'll include it in the show notes, but I want to talk about the broader implications for this. The internet, at this point, is a right-wing propaganda machine. Obviously not as a whole, but major platforms are pushing that content, profiting from it, and perpetuating it. Elon Musk's X is now a hub for CSAM and non-consensual deepfakes, but its other claim to fame is having a Rhodesia apologist spouting white nationalist talking points nonstop. Oh, and by the way, this guy owns the website. Meta is run by a sycophantic nerd who desperately wants Trump to continue the massive AI investment that they're keeping their tabs on. They hide reports that their product harms kids, they've been indicted in perpetuating a genocide in Myanmar, and their apps now spout out AI slop that feeds the right-wing outrage machine. News is also banned there in Canada, leading most people to screenshots or just straight-up lies by dishonest actors. TikTok, at least in the US, is now owned by a company controlled by Larry Ellison, a Trump-aligned billionaire. And their terms of service, again in the US, now say they're collecting info on national identity and gender alignment. Oh, and precise location data. So these are the main social media platforms that people use in their day-to-day. And most people now get their news from social media. Add in the collapse of traditional news media and the over-reliance of independent publications on the internet and social platforms to spread their reporting, you have a problem. Politicians, especially from the right, know that their greatest strength lies on communicating their message to get into office. If the message is most effectively communicated where the people are willing to receive it, that means social media. Traditional media is in trouble. So how do they preserve the relationships that form the majority of their coverage? Well, you don't necessarily flatter them, although opinion pieces and panels certainly do that, but it's not to challenge them too aggressively. I believe the Davos speech by Carney was the first litmus test of this in the specific Canadian context. And holy sh**, did news media as a whole fail. I wrote a piece at the end of last year coining 2025 as the year journalism failed. CBC's cross-country checkup invited people like David Frum and Kevin O'Leary to talk about the US's annexation threats, not considering that such a violation of international law and sovereignty makes the whole discussion a farce. AI slopaganda has worked its way into people's feeds and into newsrooms. The Local and The Grind both had to intercept in projects because somebody was suspected of using AI in writing them, which made up things that were, charitably, let's say, not true. Polyev's greatest political scandal last year was criticizing the RCMP. Was his reason stupid? Yes, but the line was there. Our brave police officers should not be targeted with these negative comments. Since the initial days of the internet, we were told that we're in the information age. Obviously, that's given away to the disinformation age. I think right now is a little different. I'm not trying to coin a phrase or act like it's an eloquent way to put it, but it's to the point. We're in the bullshit years. It truly started in earnest with Israel's genocide of Gaza. We all saw the videos. We saw the anguish, the genocidal glee of the perpetrators. But we were told by both our governments and the news media that this was a complicated issue with many different angles. That went on for years. Credibility was destroyed. It was murdered in Gaza, along with dozens upon dozens of journalists. Now we see the cowardly simpering of news outlets to power. We all see what's happening in the US. Canada is teetering on the edge. Things are bad. Really bad. There are solutions, and it's not too late. Say it with me, folks. Organize with your neighbors, your workplace, talk to people, demand better from your newsrooms, demand better consistently. Communities are the most important thing to us right now. That's why they're under constant threat. You may have seen the footage of a man being executed in the street by ICE agents in Minneapolis. I want to read some headlines on the killing from some Canadian news media outlets. Here's three from the CBC. Minnesota asks courts to curtail immigration blitz after two shootings, as Trump says his borders are. Videos appear to show fatal Minnesota shooting that has widened divide between state federal officials. Man killed in another shooting involving federal officers in Minneapolis. Here's one from the Globe and Mail. Minneapolis shooting victim Alex Preddy was an ICU nurse upset at Trump's immigration crackdowns, family say. No mention of who shot him. Here's the Toronto Star. A Minnesota nurse is the sixth person to die during the U.S. immigration crackdown. Now, these are the starkest examples, but some headlines do point out the reality, the content usually being from the Associated Press. The man killed by a U.S. Border Patrol officer in Minneapolis was an ICU nurse, family says. That's an AP article published in the Toronto Star. But the broader pattern is troubling.